Topic number two. My friends, during the past 2.5 years, a drastic shift has been taking place in the relationship between the Soviet Union and the United States. In a pale and carefully controlled way, this shift has been reflected in the public deterioration of so-called détente. But behind the scenes, the real shift has been far more profound. Politically, the secret alliance of nearly 60 years standing between our own unseen rulers and the rulers of Russia has been terminated unilaterally by the Russians. This astonishing turn of events was not foreseen by America's real rulers. As I first mentioned in audio letter number 28 last November 1977, and as I discussed in detail last month, it has to do with a fundamental change in the power structure of the Kremlin. And now, as we are on the threshold of Nuclear War I, our unseen rulers are no longer confronting the carefully programmed war they had been planning on, but a genuine free-for-all. For the first time in the 20th century, a major war is coming that will not be controlled on both sides by our unseen rulers. As these changes have been taking place in the political sphere, unexpected and revolutionary changes have also been taking place in the military equation. Our unseen rulers have been pursuing secret military projects unknown to the public for nearly 2 decades, but they have made gross miscalculations in their secret master military strategy. That strategy came to ruin 1 year ago last month in the secret space battle of the Harvest Moon, which I reported that month in audio letter 26. So now, the United States is feverishly rearming for war. Our unseen rulers are trying to fight off their own rising panic as they see disaster looming closer and closer. War is now so close that they are beginning to shed some of the cloak of secrecy surrounding formerly super-secret weapons programs. When I first revealed them long ago, I was generally not believed, but secrecy always exacts a toll of increased time to carry out a project, and they no longer have any time to spare. And so just this month, the public has been allowed to get just a glimpse of secret work in 2 areas of critical importance. One is that of underwater missiles. The other is that of beam weapons, especially the awesome charged particle beam. In audio letter 13 for June 1976, I revealed the beginning of Russia's total military double-cross of their former secret partners, who then controlled America, the four Rockefeller brothers. Based on very solid information from my own confidential sources, I reported that a nuclear weapon was resting in the waters of Seal Harbor on Mount Desert Island, Maine. It had been planted there by the Russians, where it would be able to vaporize the summer homes of David and Nelson Rockefeller. As I say these words, Nelson Rockefeller is trying to sell his Seal Harbor home, which has been owned by the Rockefeller family for 2 generations. Likewise, many wealthy Rockefeller associates in the area seem to have lost their enthusiasm for the beauty of Mount Desert Island. Like Nelson Rockefeller, they're trying to sell their property in the area and bail out. But my report of June 1976 about the Seal Harbor bomb led to far more than the present unsettled real estate conditions there. It proved to high intelligence that the Dr. Beter audio letter could be trusted to tell the truth. And from that point onward, I began receiving large amounts of intelligence information that is not entrusted to any other public information channel. Only the following month, July 1976, I revealed in audio letter 14 that a new missile crisis was underway. It was the underwater missile crisis of 1976, a far more dangerous affair than the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. The Russian Navy was planting short-range underwater-launched nuclear missiles at strategic locations within our own territorial waters. They were preparing for a nuclear Pearl Harbor-type surprise attack based on naval strategy. This intended first strike was to be totally different in nature from the ICBM first strikes we hear about all the time. Unlike an ICBM attack, the Russian underwater missiles would provide no warning at all because they were planted only miles from their targets and inside our radar defenses. At the beginning of August 1976, I recorded AUDIO LETTER 15 on an urgent basis. The Russian Navy was working fast, and nothing at all was being done to stop it. There was only one hope that the hands of America's military would be untied in time to avert imminent disaster. That slim hope lay in making the situation a public issue and bringing the United States government under sufficient public pressure to bring about appropriate action. So in AUDIO LETTER 15, I spelled out the locations of 64 Russian underwater launch missiles and hydrogen bombs in navigational coordinates. They had been planted in the territorial waters not only of the United States, but of 24 other countries worldwide. Very soon, Russia would have been in a position to erase all naval power on Earth, opposing that of the Soviet Union. At the push of a button, launch commands would have flashed worldwide by satellite, and within moments, coastal target areas all over the world would have begun vanishing in nuclear fireballs. My listeners responded by showering the Pentagon with tapes, telegrams, letters, and telephone calls. This unexpected and overwhelming public pressure did the job, temporarily, and by the end of August 1976, the United States Navy had removed all the missiles and bombs in our waters. Likewise, those around Great Britain had been pulled out by the Royal Navy. In AUDIO LETTER 16, I reviewed the tense events that had been taking place. These included my meeting at the Pentagon that month on September 16, 1976, with General George S. Brown, then Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. By that time, many of my critics who did not have my information sources were ridiculing my exposure of the Russian underwater missile crisis. Some tried to say that there would be no reason for the Russians to do such a thing, since they already have ICBMs. In doing so, they glossed over the paramount strategic value of surprise, which would be produced by the zero warning time of the Russian underwater missiles. But most of my critics simply waved it all aside by saying such a thing is not feasible. They tried to say there's no such thing as underwater missiles, so my claims about a secret crisis could not be true. But meanwhile, I met with General Brown, then top military officer in the United States, for well over an hour in his office, because by then the Russians were far along in planting a second round of these so-called impossible missiles in our waters. Just as before, crucial information about them was being blocked from reaching General Brown through normal channels. So as I explained in AUDIO LETTER 16 that month, General Brown had invited me to confer with him as soon as I alerted him about my new information. Of course, if my information in AUDIO LETTER 15 had not proven correct, General Brown would have had no reason to meet with me. Through the end of September 1976, General Brown continued to direct American activities to stave off the Russian underwater missile threat. But as I reported in AUDIO LETTER 17, the treasonous Red Friday Agreement, signed on October 1, 1976, by then-President Gerald Ford, ended all that. Soon thereafter, General Brown was cut down. He was humiliated over nationwide television, over trumped-up criticisms of his conduct, when his only real crime was doing his duty. He was shown that he would have no chance of helping himself or America by going public in any way, as I discussed in AUDIO LETTER 17 and in AUDIO LETTER 23 for April 1977. Concerning what I told you then about the neutralization of General Brown, consider the words attributed to General Brown by the Atlanta Journal this past August 3, 1978, with regard to the usefulness of quitting in protest over a policy decision. General Brown was quoted as saying, "I was perfectly prepared to do it, but I had to ask myself, what good would it do? It would not reverse a decision. No, it would be like a pebble on the beach. They'd get another chairman tomorrow." Unquote. After General Brown was neutralized, our unseen rulers tried in vain to reinstate their secret alliance and therefore a controlled war with the Soviet Union. As part of their insane effort in this direction, they allowed the Russian Navy to resume planting their underwater missiles without harassment. And as I reported to you nearly 2 years ago in AUDIO LETTER 20, this policy was based partly on the existence of a secret fleet of American undersea missiles. Unlike the small, short-range Russian missiles, the American missiles were mammoth offensive ballistic missiles. They were planted in the Atlantic and Pacific in the secret Operation Desktop under CIA control. In their undersea resting places, as I explained in AUDIO LETTER 20, they were invulnerable to attack. They were also the largest, most powerful nuclear missiles on Earth, dwarfing our conventional ICBMs. And their purpose was blackmail, to make sure Russia followed the script during Nuclear War I. But I also revealed then that the CIA's undersea super missiles were springing leaks one by one and being ruined. The following month, in fact, nuclear debris from one of these leaking missiles off Florida, Atlantic Missile No. 8, poisoned large numbers of whales in the area. More than 120 of them beached themselves to die near Jacksonville, Florida, in only a few days' time. To this very day, many self-proclaimed instant experts among my critics have kept telling their followers that undersea missiles like these are impossible. And while they always cry for documentation, they have totally ignored the documentation I presented in AUDIO LETTER 20. Mr. Tony Hodges, a prominent Honolulu environmentalist, had unearthed information about the definite feasibility of undersea missile systems from experts. In December 1975, he published a warning document on the situation, from which I quoted in AUDIO LETTER 20. It seems that expert testimony is not enough to convince most people of the truth. What it takes is to see it on television or in the newspapers. Well, my friends, it has finally begun to happen. 11 days ago, on October 18th, CBS Television News carried a report about Pentagon studies now underway on underwater missile systems. The next day, Radio Australia went further and disclosed that, quote, "Pentagon generals have shown President Carter an outline of a scheme to submerge huge diesel-driven craft off the American coast to create a nuclear missile system less vulnerable to the increasingly accurate Soviet warheads," unquote. But my friends, the undersea diesel launcher concept is just a cover story for the real undersea missile crash program now in progress. 6 months ago in AUDIO LETTER 33, I revealed that Operation Desktop had been reactivated. As I explained then, a fresh fleet of CIA undersea missiles was to be planted beginning off America's Atlantic coast under the cover of drilling for oil. At that time, the Baltimore Canyon area where the drilling is taking place was being touted as an oil bonanza for the United States. Today, it's 6 months later, and news reports have been telling for months now about one dry hole after another. If they were really looking for oil, the whole thing would be seen as a fiasco by now. But instead, the work goes on day and night at site after site, and soon the oil companies will line up to bid for additional leases in the area. I can now reveal that as of now, 7 new CIA undersea super missiles are in place off our Atlantic coast, and the Russians know exactly where each one is, because hovering overhead there are presently 5 Cosmospheres on patrol armed with charged particle beam weapons which can destroy the missiles as soon as they are launched. As unnerving as the race in underwater missiles may be, it now takes a back seat to the race in beam weapons. This involves not only high-power lasers, but the even more devastating particle beam weapons. Last September 1977, I reported Russia's first operational use of particle beam weapons in space. On September 20, 1977, the Russians blasted an American spy satellite into a huge fireball in space as it passed over the Petrozavodsk Observatory in northern Russia. And barely a week later, on September 27, 1977, the secret American moon base in Copernicus Crater was silenced by Russia's neutron beam attack from Earth orbit. America had just lost the Battle of the Harvest Moon. Immediately, America was forced to stop short in her secret beam weapons race with Russia, for suddenly our unseen rulers were teetering on the edge of war itself, and Russia suddenly was calling the shots. Just as happened in the matter of the underwater missile systems, many people were soon ridiculing the idea of operational Russian particle beam weapons. Such a thing, they said, was far in the future, if not impossible. But what I made public then was true, my friends. And now, after one short year, there has been a complete change in the public attitude of top American defense experts. The reason is that in the kamikaze do-or-die strategy of our unseen rulers against Russia, beam weapons are now being tackled in a crash program. And only by letting it become visible in a controlled way can maximum use be made of our technical resources and manpower. Most members of the general public probably have heard very little about the sudden new emphasis on beam weapons in the United States. But in technical circles, which is perhaps where it matters most, it is now very widely known. Earlier this month, on October 2nd, Aviation Week and Space Technology magazine, an aerospace industry publication, began a series of articles about America's sudden new plunge into beam weapons. One article quotes a Pentagon official as saying, quote, "Beam weapons are no longer in the gee whiz Buck Rogers death ray category, and senior Carter administration members no longer give it the back of their hand like they once did," unquote. Based on the assessment of what Aviation Week refers to as a top-level United States official, the article continues in the words, quote, "The general attitude in the past year has changed from one of skepticism over the possibility of fielding particle beam weapons to one of speculation that beam weapons may be possible within a reasonable time," unquote. At another point in the article, Aviation Week relates the belief of United States Air Force officials that a space-based anti-satellite neutral beam system could be operational, quote, "within a couple of years. It would be much sooner than you might believe," unquote. In other words, my friends, when I told you about America's defeat in the Battle of the Harvest Moon 1 year ago, the official line was that such weapons were virtually impossible. But now, America's panic rearmament is underway. So now we are told these weapons are just around the corner. Nevertheless, we are supposed to perish the thought that Russia already has these weapons deployed. Because once we realize that, we will all know that our Bolshevik rulers are leading us into national suicide. All of our ICBMs and bombers will be of little use against a Russia defended with particle beam weapons. In his editorial of October the 2nd earlier this month, Aviation Week editor Robert Holtz, a highly informed American, said, quote, "Beam weapons offer the promise of reducing strategic nuclear weapons to a negligible factor in the future. If successfully deployed, beam weapons can end the long reign of nuclear terror introduced by the ballistic missile and its thermonuclear warhead," unquote. My friends, the reign of nuclear terror spoken of by Holtz has already ended for Russia. As I reported last year, the Russian rulers signaled this fact on September 27, 1977, the very day that the Battle of the Harvest Moon ended in victory for Russia. That day, Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko denounced the United States in a speech at the United Nations. In addition, I now quote the exact words I said in AUDIO LETTER 26. Gromyko added that the Soviet Union is now ready to halt underground nuclear tests for a while, even if others do not. The reason for this statement, which surprised everyone, is that the particle beam has now superseded other nuclear weapons as the front line of Soviet armaments, unquote. To quote one further line from the Holtz editorial, "If the Soviets achieve this capability first, it will give them enormous crucial leverage in imposing their political will on the rest of the world," unquote. My friends, the Russians have achieved the particle beam capability first. and as I explained last month, they are preparing now to dominate the rest of the world with it. Russia's rulers have no intention of permitting our unseen rulers to save themselves by means of panic rearmament, for Russia is monitoring not only the political and economic progress of the Bolshevik Revolution here. She is also keeping a close watch on America's war preparations. Russia's sheer momentum is so great that time is on Russia's side right now, and the military gap between East and West is growing wider every day. But as America's rearmament progresses, there will come a point when that gap will stop widening and begin to narrow. From that time onward, time will no longer be on Russia's side, so Russia will wait no longer. When Russia's advantage is at a maximum, war will come. Meanwhile, Russia's rulers are using the time remaining in efforts to neutralize as much of the world as possible before the war, as I explained last month. The real reason for Russia's determination to wage nuclear war on America, my friends, is the Bolshevik control that is now seizing our land at all levels. The only way to prevent war would be our own swift action to throw out the Bolsheviks and remove the threat they pose to Russia. Rearmament cannot save America. It cannot prevent war, and it cannot give us victory in war. It can only guarantee that America will endure the wrath of sabotage, geophysical warfare, nuclear weapons, particle beam weapons, invasion, and occupation. So by panic rearmament, the Bolsheviks are bringing on national suicide for the United States of America. Topic number 3. On the night of the harvest moon last year, Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko delivered a sudden late-night message to Jimmy Carter at the White House. Government spokesmen in the major media portrayed the message as a breakthrough in the SALT II negotiations. But as I revealed 3 days later, Gromyko's real message was an ultimatum. The Battle of the Harvest Moon had just taken place in space, and in a stunning upset, Russia had won. Ever since then, the SALT talks have been a mask hiding the true face of Soviet-American relations. Time and again, we the public have been told of encouraging progress on SALT. Time and again, we have been assured that a SALT accord was, quote, 95% complete, unquote. And time and again, this has been followed by reports of new snags, and the euphoria has evaporated. The cycle has been repeated over and over, and today, 13 months after the alleged SALT breakthrough, it is being done again. Early this month, there was official optimism, quote-unquote. Now there is caution, quote-unquote. And even the alleged new snags are always over the same stale old issues, the backfire bomber and so on. But this month, there was a change. 1 year ago this month, I reported that Russia was pressuring the United States to surrender through secret provisions of a SALT II treaty to disarm America. But now, we are committed to rearming in secret. Even if SALT II does come eventually, it will be purely cosmetic for propaganda on both sides. And this month, Chief American Arms Negotiator Paul C. Warnke resigned. His specialty in arms matters has always been the dismantling of American military might, so he no longer fits the changed climate for war. Meanwhile, war preparations are quietly speeding up on all fronts. Effective the first of this month, the length of basic training has been shortened throughout the armed forces. Also this month, the biggest mobilization readiness test since World War II got underway for reserves in the National Guard. The exercise is codenamed Nifty Nugget and runs from October 10 through November 8. By stretching it out this way, maximum use is being made of routine weekend drill periods, thereby avoiding widespread public attention to such a major exercise. On the international scene, too, the urgency is becoming apparent. The three countries whose real estate is critical to the American First Strike plan, namely Norway, Iran, and China, are increasingly in the news. As I explained in detail 2 months ago, American subcraft, that is, submersible aircraft, are to attack Russia's four cosmodromes from Norway and Iran. From China's Sinkan province, Russia's two cosmosphere installations in Siberia are to be attacked. But since late June, Russian intelligence ships have been stopping in northern Norwegian waters scouting out the subcraft staging areas. And in August, a large Russian spy plane crashed on a northern Norwegian island, further heightening the tension there. Iran, for her part, was devastated by a huge earthquake last month, brought about by Russian geophysical warfare, as I explained last month. Iran now wants to cancel purchases of 70 F-14 fighter bombers, 140 F-16 fighters, 31 F-4 Phantom jets, and 1,000 air-to-ground missiles. But what was praised most by Moscow radio was Iran's reported decision to back out of buying the so-called AWACS airborne spy system. It was to have been used along the border with Russia to monitor Russian military activities. As for China, the tug of war between East and West continues on the surface, but as I reported last month, Russia and China have already reached an agreement in principle for a secret alliance. And 6 days ago, on October 23rd, the Sino-Japanese Peace Treaty went into effect, and Russian geophysical warfare will force Japan to sign up with Russia soon. The great new Asian axis, Tokyo, Peking, and Moscow, which I warned about 5 years ago in my book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar, is coming into being. This month, 4 American spy bases in Turkey were reopened for 1 year. The arms embargo against Turkey has been lifted, and on October 23, so was the arms embargo against Pakistan. The United States is now considering arms aid to Somalia, and behind the scenes, American official behavior toward Rhodesia and South Africa is changing. It seems our unseen rulers want all the allies they can salvage for the coming war. My friends, as we are confronted today by the evil forces of Bolshevism in our midst and the threat of war, we should recall these words, quote, "We have no spiritual glow, no fervor, no fire against evil. We stand facing war today with the impassivity of a person who stands motionless before the flood, simply because he did not wish the flood." Unquote. These are the words of journalist and lecturer Frederick Snyder, which were spoken on November 30, 1941, just 1 week before Pearl Harbor. And today, my friends, all of America is a Pearl Harbor. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.